program. So help out your community radio station today. This is KPFT Houston.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This show is also syndicated on WHYR 96.9 FM in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Today on the show, we will talk about the situation in occupied Jerusalem, where Israel shot and killed several Palestinians over the past week and injured more than 1,000. We will talk about that with Saeed Uriqat, journalist, author, and political analyst. He is the Washington, D.C. bureau chief of the daily Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds, based in occupied Jerusalem. And there is a lot of breaking news coming from Jerusalem as we speak right now. We will be talking about all that during this show. We will also listen to a speech about the anti-BDS legislation. That's the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And the First Amendment. This is a speech by Maria Lahoud, Deputy Legal Director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Some of you may know there are efforts to pass legislation that will impose fines of hundreds of thousands of dollars and even imprisonment for supporting BDS, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, yes, right here in the United States. But first, a few announcements from Arab Voices Community Calendar. The Syrian American Club in Houston is offering a scholarship program for qualified students in the community for the 2017 and 2018 academic year. They have been doing this, by the way, for 22 years or so. Students who graduated from high school this year and plan to attend college are encouraged to apply. Students who are undergraduates in a four-year college program may also apply if they are in their junior year or below. A limited number of scholarships will be awarded to those with the highest qualifications and or greatest need. More information about the scholarship is posted on our website, arabvoices.net. Last week on the show, you heard us talk about the Summer of Hope program with two of its organizers, a program that provides free English language and life skills training to the Syrian refugee children living right here in Houston. Well, tomorrow there will be a Summer of Hope informational meeting and discussion about the achievements and hopes for this Summer of Hope program for Syrian refugees. It will be held at the Syrian American Club on 5729 Winsome Lane from 7 to 8 p.m. Again, that's tomorrow, Thursday evening. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center, ACC, in Houston will resume its Saturday Arabic classes in September. There will be a meeting with teachers as well as registration on September 9th. There will be Arabic classes for youth and adults. To learn more about the school and to register, call 832-351-3366 or email school@acchouston.org. In case you have not heard, efforts are underway by several legislators to pass a new Israel anti-boycott bill. This started several months ago, and we talked about it on the show, but revisions have been made, and it is making its way again. The Senate version of the bill, S-720, has 18 co-sponsors. Its counterpart in the House, H.R. 1697, has 91 co-sponsors. The penalties listed if someone violates this bill, listen to this, a minimum of $250,000 fine and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years imprisonment. Numerous organizations throughout the United States are against this bill, including the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and many, many, many others. We are going to listen now to a talk titled Anti-BDS Legislation and the First Amendment, recent legislation that threatens First Amendment rights of Palestinian solidarity activists and the legal challenges thereto. It was given by Maria Lahoud, Deputy Legal Director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. It was delivered at the Israel Lobby and American Policy Conference, which was held on March 24th, 2017, at the National Press Club. So let's listen to that talk. First, you will hear the voice of Dale Sprusansky, Assistant Editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, introducing Maria Lahoud.
As I mentioned earlier, we had one speaker change today, and that is that Columbia Law Professor Catherine Franke, who was scheduled to speak, came down with pneumonia. But no need to worry, because we have the wonderful Maria Lahoud here to take her place. Maria will be addressing an immensely important topic. As many of you know, there has recently been a rash of anti-BDS legislation introduced and passed at both the state and federal levels. These anti-BDS bills have raised concerns about the First Amendment rights of Palestinian solidarity activists. They have also kept the lives of lawyers such as Maria very busy. Maria is a deputy legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She has worked tirelessly to defend the rights of those who face legal pushback for challenging Israel's policies. She has defended Olympia Food Co-op board members for boycotting Israeli goods, represented Professor Steven Saleta, who was terminated from a tenured position for tweets critical of Israel. She also works closely with Palestine Legal to support students whose speech is being suppressed for their Palestinian advocacy. For those of you who were here last year, you will remember her brilliant overview of the challenges faced by Palestinian advocates on campus. This year, she will be discussing the recent legislation that threatens First Amendment rights of Palestinian activists and the legal challenges there, too. We couldn't be happier to have her with us here today and are so happy she agreed to join us at the last second.
Thank you very much. Thanks to IRMEP and the American Educational Trust for inviting me to speak. It's an honor to be here with you all. Israel has declared that BDS is the biggest threat it faces. As mentioned earlier, it has recently banned BDS supporters from even entering the country. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions is a nonviolent, time-honored tactic to demand basic rights, such as equality. Proponents of BDS simply demand that Israel comply with international law. Yet tens of millions of dollars are being spent to combat BDS, to combat a peaceful means of seeking social change and respect for human rights. Students for Justice in Palestine groups have been active all over the country educating their campuses. This is despite being maligned as uncivil, divisive, anti-Semitic, or supportive of terrorism. Despite being investigated and disciplined when they protest, despite the bureaucratic barriers they face when they try to form a club or bring in a speaker to talk about BDS. Recently, the administration of Fordham in New York rejected students' application to even form an SJP, stating that it was polarizing and that calling for BDS is a barrier to open dialogue, and claiming that SJP groups at other schools have engaged in misconduct. Each of these reasons violates basic principles of free speech and free association, not to mention a university's mission to foster intellectual and moral development and open inquiry. Despite widespread efforts to suppress activism for Palestinian rights, it is on the rise, on campuses and off. The U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights has a list of 170-plus United States BDS victories. Students have passed divestment resolutions on campuses all over the country. Numerous churches and foundations have divested from companies facilitating the occupation. And the culture and academic boycott continues to grow. Six NFL players recently pulled out of an Israeli-sponsored government trip to Israel. As we know, when there's no defense, the tactic of a bully is to silence, malign, or intimidate the speaker. According to the Emergency Committee for Israel, which has supported the nationwide anti-BDS legislative effort, legislating against BDS tells its proponents, while you were doing your campus antics, the grown-ups were in the state legislatures passing laws that make your cause improbable. Thus far, 16 states have passed anti-BDS legislation of one form or another. The Israeli Foreign Ministry, in cooperation with Israel advocacy organizations, is reportedly behind the anti-BDS laws. Several of these laws establish a public blacklist of entities that boycott Israel and prevent the state from investing in them or contracting with them. The first such law was passed in Illinois in 2015, and it blacklists foreign companies that boycott and requires the state's pension fund to divest from them. Florida and Arizona pass laws to create blacklists of companies and other entities that boycott, and the state is prevented from contracting with them as well as investing in them. Maryland currently has similar blacklist bills pending, which also apply to natural persons and non-governmental organizations, meaning that individuals, churches, foundations, trade unions, and other groups could be blacklisted for boycotting or divesting from corporations complicit in Israel's violations. The bills are supported by the Jewish Community Relations Council, but there's a large, well-organized, broad-based coalition fighting them, so they are lingering, and in Maryland, the legislative session ends on April 10th. Activists had mobilized against similar bills in New York, so Governor Cuomo bypassed the legislative process, which he called tedious, and issued an executive order to create a blacklist of institutions and companies that the state must divest from. Incidentally, the executive order that Governor Cuomo signed was signed on the day of the Celebrate Israel Day parade in New York. The American Jewish Committee lobbied for the New York law, and Governor Cuomo has been named co-chair of AJC's Governors Against BDS initiative. Thus far, the state blacklists that exist in Illinois, Florida, and Arizona, no, not Arizona, in Illinois, Florida, and New York have only named foreign corporations. Not to say that others couldn't be added in Florida and New York. Colorado has an anti-BDS list that is completely blank, and Arizona's list is due out April 1st. So although the tactic, the blacklist tactic, is pure McCarthy, the actual reach thus far is quite limited, but the chill can be much broader. And although New York already has a blacklist, earlier this month, the New York State Senate fast-tracked three bills aimed at silencing advocates of Palestinian rights with no committee hearing and no opportunity for public input or debate. And they passed with overwhelming support. One bill is like the executive order in New York, but expands the blacklist to include individuals and nonprofits. One bill would prohibit state funding for student organizations at state or city universities or community colleges that support BDS campaigns against Israel. The other would take away state funding from colleges that use state aid to fund any academic organization that advocates a boycott of Israel. Several academic institutions have endorsed the call for a boycott of Israeli academic institutions. And in 2013, when the American Studies Association did so, legislatures around the country proposed bills similar to this one, but a public outcry prevented them from passing. Companion bills have not yet been introduced in the New York Assembly for these three bills, but we're on the lookout. California passed a law requiring prospective contractors to certify under penalty of perjury that they're not violating state anti-discrimination laws, and if they have a policy against a foreign nation, that they don't use it to discriminate. The bills had originally explicitly prohibited contracting with companies that boycott Israel, but because of the mobilization against them and constitutional concerns, they were substantially revised. But the law still names no nation other than Israel and no discrimination other than against Jewish individuals under the, quote, pretext of a constitutionally protected boycott or protest of the state of Israel, unquote. A few states, Virginia, South Carolina, Massachusetts, and Tennessee, as well as Congress, have introduced bills to expand the definition of anti-Semitism to include criticism of Israel for purposes of determining whether someone is discriminated against. These bills adopt the definition of anti to include the definition. The Massachusetts bill was also defeated. These bills are problematic on many levels, including that the distorted definition undermines the fight against true anti-Semitism. Not to mention their sole focus on anti-Semitism to the exclusion of other forms of bigotry, such as the rise in Islamophobia. In December, the United States Senate passed by unanimous consent the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which would have required the Department of Education to consider the State Department definition of anti-Semitism in determining whether a university had discriminated in violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It died in the House, but it certainly could be introduced again. There is a current bill in Congress, the Combating BDS Act, supported by AIPAC and introduced by Senator Rubio, that attempts to nullify the argument that state anti-BDS laws should be struck down because they're preempted by federal law. But the main argument against these state laws is not that they're preempted, but that they violate the First Amendment. There was also the 2015 Trade Promotion Authority Law, which requires the U.S. government to discourage BDS or trade barriers against Israel in trade negotiations with European Union countries. And who knows what else is coming at the federal level. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed David Friedman as U.S. ambassador to Israel, 52-46. Friedman has taken the position that the U.S. should view BDS as inherently anti-Semitic and take strong measures, both diplomatic and legislative, to thwart it. But for all the anti-BDS bills that have passed, many more have been defeated, showing the power of mobilization, that organizing and writing and calling and meeting with your representatives makes a difference. Legislators have heard concerns that the bills are unconstitutional, but they've also heard their constituents' passionate views about Palestinian rights. It's important to remember that none of the anti-BDS laws take away your right to boycott or to advocate for BDS. Nor can they under the U.S. Constitution. They do, however, punish expression of a particular viewpoint, BDS against Israel, which is unconstitutional. Under the First Amendment, the government cannot pass a law that abridges our freedom of speech or discriminates based on viewpoint. It cannot regulate our speech based on its content or message. In a case stemming from the boycott of white businesses in Mississippi in the 1960s to demand racial equality, The Supreme Court made clear that nonviolent boycotts to bring about political, social, or economic change are protected under the First Amendment. Moreover, the government may not deny a benefit to someone for exercising their constitutional rights. We must demand that our state and local lawmakers protect our federal right to protest and dissent and reject these unconstitutional laws. And when they do pass, we must not let them chill our protected speech. But it's even more critical that we resist the distraction of focusing on our speech rights in the U.S. and instead use the fact that our legislators are actually talking about BDS against Israel as an opportunity for us to talk about Palestinian rights and freedom. We need to defend our right to engage in BDS, but we must demand an end to the occupation, to apartheid, to settlements, to the closure of Gaza, to attacks on human rights defenders in the occupied Palestinian territory who are targeted, arrested, detained, threatened, and harassed for peacefully protesting, for seeking justice and accountability. It's also essential to be uniting struggles. In addition to anti-BDS laws, and in response to recent protests across the United States, a recent wave of anti-protest bills have been introduced in state legislatures, which increase fines and impose jail time for protesters. In response to Standing Rock protests, North Dakota introduced bills that would exempt drivers from liability if they injured or killed protesters in a roadway, as long as they didn't do it intentionally. We need to keep making connections between strugglers, we need to keep making connections between settler colonialism, state violence, and racism in this country and in Israel. The struggle for Palestinian liberation is tied to all struggles against oppression. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. He also described the pivotal Montgomery bus boycott against segregation in the U.S. as a refusal to cooperate with an evil system. All over the world, including in the U.S., people are increasingly refusing to be complicit in Israel's violations of international law and are demanding the same of our government officials. It's not simply a matter of our right to dissent. It is our moral duty. Cooperation with the occupation, with apartheid, is complicity. BDS helped end apartheid in South Africa, and it will eventually do the same in Israel. The wave of anti-BDS legislation just shows the power the movement for Palestinian rights has to expose Israel's violation of international law and eventually help bring them to an end. Thank you.
What you just heard was the talk of Maria Lahoud, Deputy Legal Director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, speaking on anti-BDS legislation and the First Amendment. Her talk was delivered at the Israel Lobby and American Policy Conference on March 24, 2017, at the National Press Club. And as I mentioned earlier, there are efforts now, there are legislators who are pushing for a new bill, Israel Anti-Boycott Bill, where basically that says Bill S-720 that will make it illegal and will actually fine people who violate this bill from $250,000 to $1 million and even imprisonment of 20 years for those who boycott and divest from Israeli colonies and Israeli settlers. Amazing. This is here in the United States. By the way, five U.S. Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders, five U.S. Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders were barred from going to Israel under a new law that prohibits entry to Israel by foreign activists who advocate a boycott of the country. And those are U.S. citizens. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we will speak live with Saeed Ariqat, journalist, author, and political analyst. He is the Washington, D.C. bureau chief for the daily Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds, based in occupied Jerusalem. We will speak with him about occupied Jerusalem and the situation there, where Israel shot and killed several Palestinians and wounded more than 1,000 over the past week, in addition to all the measures that it imposed and the attacks and preventing worshippers from reaching Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray. There is breaking news from Jerusalem. As we speak, we will be talking about that also with our guest in a few minutes. We'll be right back.
بكيت حتى انتهت الدموع
صليت حتى ذابت
وبعضهم يرقد تحت
هضبة الجنة وبعدهم تأكله الأسماك في دهشة والفرا وبعضهم محاصر في ليبيا بالجوع والأحزان
Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This show is also syndicated on WHYR 96.9 FM in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Joining us now live via phone from Washington, D.C., is Saeed Ariqat. He is a journalist, author, and political analyst. He is the Washington, D.C. bureau chief of the daily Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds, based in occupied Jerusalem, for which he is a writer, columnist, and analyst. He is also an adjunct professor at the American University in Washington, D.C., where he teaches a course on the role of the media in the Arab world. He also served as spokesman and director of public information for the United Nations Assistance Mission for Iraq from 2005 to 2010. Saeed, welcome to Arab Voices.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks. It's good to have you again on the show. Jerusalem is near and dear to your heart, just like ours and many out there. It has been in the media a lot. Explosive situation in Jerusalem over the past 2 weeks or so. Several Palestinians have been shot and killed by the Israeli occupation forces. More than 1,000 were injured. Tell us and tell our listeners what caused this massive escalation in occupied Jerusalem and the Israeli measures there. And I know there is breaking news coming from Jerusalem as we speak, so I'm sure you know the details to also update us on that.
Well, let me update you on the latest. First of all, the occupation forces dismantled early Thursday morning Jerusalem time, dismantled all the the catwalk ways and fences and so on. I mean, they dismantled the electronic the metal detectors last night, and today they did this with the catwalks and so on. So I think little by little the Palestinians are able to, or Jerusalemites have been able to score a success, a victory for them, and simply by being out there every day for 14 days straight. Now, this was done under the pretext of an attack that occurred on the 14th of July. But if you recall, the attackers came from Amitahim, a town in northern Israel, and the attack were also people from the north. So Jerusalemites had nothing to do with it. Zionism collectively really was a pretext to basically overtake Al-Aqsa al-Haram Sharif. That's what they wanted to do. That's what they intended all along. That's what they did in the Ibrahimi Mosque in Khalil in Hebron back in 1994, and they thought they could get away with it. But it was obvious that the Palestinians Jerusalemites were able to struggle on their own and willing to continue this struggle, no matter how bloody and painful it is for them. They would have stuck it out, and they would still stick it out until all measures that have been done or undertaken to change the status quo are nullified. So that is, in a nutshell, what is happening.
Now, over the past 2 weeks, and what prompted tens of thousands of Palestinians from Jerusalem to rise up and defy the Israeli measures, because Israel prevented Palestinians from reaching Al-Aqsa Mosque, preventing freedom of the religion to go and pray in the mosque in occupied East Jerusalem. and also attacking them. There are videos showing Israeli soldiers brutally attacking Palestinians while they are praying. Somebody kneeling down on the ground praying, and an Israeli soldier beat the hell out of him while he was praying. Now, all of these measures that Israel inflicted on the Palestinians, they didn't want that because they know this. There is something, and you mentioned it a minute ago, it's a plan all along. Tell us more about that. What is the Israeli plan for Jerusalem and for Al-Aqsa?
Well, you know, Israel has annexed the Jerusalem, the eastern part of the city, the old city, East Jerusalem, right upon occupation, right after occupation in 1967. I consider it to be the eternal capital of Israel. And ever since then, they have been digging underneath Al-Aqsa in pursuit of really an elusive evidence that is not even there, that somehow there's a simple behind there. No one has been able to find any shred of evidence that this has ever existed. So the Israeli goal at the end is really to control Jerusalem, to control the West Bank, to take all of Palestine, and to, you know, to have a creeping settlement process that we have seen over the past 50 years now, you know, numbering close to 700,000 in the West Bank and in Jerusalem. So that is what Israel intended to all along, is to just basically cement it is, you know, its sort of stranglehold on Jerusalem, on the West Bank, spread the settlement, and Judaize, if you will, the old city, and basically drive the Arabs out. And all we have to do is listen to what, you know, their ministers are saying. They're saying that the Palestinians, if they don't calm down, they're going to face another Nakba, which means really a, you know, a euphemism for ethnic cleansing once more, a third Nakba, that's what they call it. So that is the process that the West Bank and Palestinian land in general has been undergoing for the past 50 years. The same thing in Gaza. I mean, Gaza is besieged. People think that the Israelis pulled out of Gaza. No, that is not the case. The Israel pulled out of its settlers from Gaza and put them elsewhere in the West Bank, but it kept basically occupying the region, surrounding the region, the perimeter of Gaza. They shoot at well people that work within the boundaries of Gaza. They shoot fishermen and so on. So their methodical plan for the Palestinians is basically to do away with them. If they could, you know, throw them all out of Palestine, then they will do it. But, of course, it is very difficult and all over to do. The Palestinians are there and not going anywhere. And they will continue to resist, as we have seen. They have an amazing energy, an amazing will to keep going forward.
And we know that we have heard this over the years. Israel is trying to make it, and many in the Israeli government and the religious parties within Israel are trying to make it as if it's a religious conflict, a religious war. And some claim that this belongs to us anyway, Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa Mosque, for our listeners, is one of the holiest sites in Islam for 1.7 plus billion Muslims in the world. It's so significant. It's important to the Muslim world. And they claim that it's a temple mount there, and that they have to build a third temple in place of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. So to them, that Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, they must be demolished, wiped out, so they can build a temple in their place.
Yeah, well, that is true. I mean, you know, look, it is definitely very important for the Palestinians, and they are the ones that are right there in the front line defending Jerusalem. So we tip our hat off to them. They are fantastic, amazing, resourceful people, the occupation notwithstanding. But it's also very important for the Arabs and the Muslims. I mean, remember when Yasser Arafat, the last Palestinian president, was undergoing negotiations for Camp David, in Camp David with Ehud Barak, he was approached actually by the Turkish, a Turkish envoy, who said, look, you know, the Israelis are willing to give you sovereignty over the mosque, on top of the mosque, and they will maintain sovereignty underneath the mosque. And he said, look, if you can convince the Turkish people in doing this, then I'm fine with it. Obviously knowing that Jerusalem is very holy for the Muslims, for the Arabs, but most of all for the Palestinians. So it's a sovereignty issue. It has nothing to do with religion. Israel isn't they want to have it as a religious war. It is certainly to lose. So it is certainly to lose. although this was never really about religion. It's about colonialism. It is about occupation. Since day one, the Zionist movement, it was always a colonial movement. It was not a religious movement. Religion was always used as a pretext so they can come and occupy the land and basically ethnically cleanse it of its inhabitants and of its Palestinian population.
And absolutely, and that's and there are so many happenings in Jerusalem. I want to talk about them shortly. But as you mentioned, this small victory was just about Israel to dismantle the electronic surveillance that it put in occupied Jerusalem towards Al-Aqsa Mosque, and putting metal detectors and so-called smart cameras. They even were forced to remove that. So Israel bowed. Gave up finally and removed all that stuff. They are still being verified as we speak, but that's what it seems, what's happening right now in occupied Jerusalem as we speak. But there is a whole lot more that Israel continues to do to change the what's happening demographically on the ground, to change Jerusalem.
Right.
And of course it happens throughout the occupied through no building permits, to house demolitions, to residency provocations, ongoing raids. The apartheid wall, military roadblocks, the settlers, the colonizers who are living on Palestinian land. Israel continues to increase land and steal and grab more land from the Palestinians for the colonizers. And the restrictions of movements, I mean, it's ongoing every single day. While no peace, no talks, nothing is progressing on the political arena. And Israel is the number one winner, gainer, because of its practices and what it does on the ground.
Right. But there's one area where Israel loses all along and every step of the way. Remember, Israel's legitimacy can only come from Palestinians. So that's why they keep insisting that they want the Palestinians to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Because then they can, only then they can forfeit and forego their historical rights in Palestine, which will never happen. So we have seen that the Palestinians are growing in population, but also they are growing in resolve. And that is what is really important. After 70 years, the Palestinians have not given up. They have not shown any signs of being worn out. They are willing to do it today with the same kind of energy that they have done in the Intifada in 1987 and the Intifada in 1981, and all of the Intifadas. I mean, you know, it's not only 87 that the Palestinians had an Intifada. You can go all the way back to the 1920s. Of last century, and you find that there were one intifada after another, Habbad, Jamahiriya, all along by the Palestinians, fighting all along. So that is really the one issue that Israel is unable to sort of, to come to terms with, that the Palestinians are not going to disappear, and they will continue to resist until they achieve their goals of having their own national entity free from occupation, free from the checkpoints, free from harassment, you know, free from humiliations and so on. And certainly the Palestinians have had many setbacks, most of all a leadership that has not been able to deliver for them, but also they have made many victories in the past. The fact that they continue to be there, they continue to resist, they continue to endure this occupation, and despite it all, they are resolved to remain on their land is really a tremendous victory.
Now, obviously, the Palestinians themselves, just like as you explained, they made that big difference on their own terms, on the ground. But a question, you mentioned the Palestinian Authority and the leadership. President Abbas announced several days ago suspending all contacts, all communication, all cooperation between the Palestinian authorities and the Israeli government because of what's happening in Jerusalem. Do you think that made any difference whatsoever?
No, I don't think so. I think that what made a difference at the end of the day is the Palestinians themselves that are resisting and struggling. But having said this, this security coordination is shameful. It must end because all along it was a one-way thing. And when they say coordination, it means that the Palestinians are basically aiding and helping the occupation forces going after innocent Palestinians. That's what security coordination is all about. And these are some of the pitfalls that are in the Oslo Accord. If you look at the Oslo Accord allowed Israel to have a creeping annexation of every part of the West Bank. It allowed them to create more settlements and so on. So that is the problem. There should be no coordination whatsoever. There should be, definitely there should not be any security coordination whatsoever, but Israel continues to occupy the land, put torture the Palestinians, imprison the Palestinians. That must go. That did not need, you know, a lot of intifada for Abbas to say, I will no longer cooperate with the Israelis, because that is definitely something that should have never been done to begin with. But even when it was done, as the Israelis showed that they have no good say whatsoever in pursuing these agreements, then it should have stopped back then. They really need the Palestinian leadership. It needs today to retake stock of where they stand, what they have delivered, why they failed, and what is the source of that failure. And then you look at new, they need a new political platform so they can pursue their national goal for liberation, for freedom in their homeland. This leadership has proven itself to be inept. And I say this lightly, that is the truth. So it is obvious that the president of Palestine, Mahmoud Abbas, tried to salvage some of the popularity that he may still have, although he doesn't really have much. Fatah, the same thing. The PLO is the same thing. They're saying, look, you know, we need to sort of save whatever can be saved, save face in this case for them. So it's not a moment too late. It should have happened. It's not a moment too soon. It should have happened years ago.
And we see from, other than the Palestinian Authority, there are some efforts made by the United Nations, UNESCO,
right,
the so-called Arab League. But at the end of the day, Israel doesn't give a damn to anybody out there whatsoever. You deal with foreign entities a lot as a journalist in Washington, D.C. You cover them. You know what's happening there. What about the United States government under the Trump administration and what we have seen so far?
Well, I'll tell you what, that's a great question, because I go to the State Department every day, and this is a question that I raise daily. It's my article is actually about this today, that was published today. So you're right. This is an administration that came into office promising that it will be totally in support of Israel. Whatever action Israel does, it will be in support of it. The Republican platform of last year's convention, and I was there, they took out any reference to the two-state solution. When Trump greeted, when President Trump greeted Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on the 15th of February of this year, he said one state, two state, he doesn't care. He's basically giving them a green light. He said you should really scale back on the settlement activity. But he has given them a green light to go ahead and accelerate the settlement process without any, you know, any kind of expressing outrage or concern, like at least the former administration said from time to time they would issue a statement. So this is a very pro-Israeli, pro-Likud, pro-Netanyahu White House. Remember, Jared Kushner sits on the board of Beit Eil, one of the largest settlement blocks. His family donated $18 million to this settlement. David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, who is basically was working behind the scenes and working directly with Kushner and so on, without even going back to the State Department. David Friedman sits on the board of the settlement of Beit Eil, has always worked with them. He is very pro-settlement. The same thing with Jason Greenblatt. So what you have a team that has been designated to foresee the process, foresee the peace process, and the resumption of peace talks, so to speak, between Palestinians and Israelis, who are basically, you know, of the same mindset as all the settlers. They donate to the settlement process. They're very close to Benjamin Netanyahu. So, to summarize what I'm saying, this administration, there isn't much that can be expected from it. Obviously, they didn't really say much beyond, you know, adhering to what they are obligated to by international norms and standards, which is we must maintain the status quo, because Jerusalem has a status quo. And that status quo even predates 1967. It is back to 1949. There is a set of resolutions that says Jerusalem is a separate entity. We must deal with it this way and that way. So, yes, while the government has said that much in response to my question, we adhere to the status quo, they really have not done anything to pressure Benjamin. You know, quite the contrary. Jared Kushner took the time to pressure the King of Jordan so he can release that murderer security service Israelis that killed two Jordanians. So that is what this administration, its position on the peace process, its position on the Palestinian-Israeli issue. They are basically behind Israel 100%.
Yes, and isn't Netanyahu part of the Likud government?
Yes, of course
now,
he is.
And, what I wanted to say is you mentioned the Likud, and to my knowledge, I was reading it last night, didn't the Likud's something like ideological voting entity or ideological bureau, they voted late last night to oppose a creation of Palestinian state
right.
in 1967 period and prepare for the collapse of the Palestinian Authority?
Right. Absolutely. You know, the thing is Israel does not want to see the collapse Palestinian Authority because the Palestinian Authority has been doing a great job for the Israelis. So they don't want to see it go. But they want the pretension. They want that, you know, appearance of having some sort of a Palestinian entity that they can interlocute with, to have, sort of this equanimity between something Palestinian and something Israeli, while in fact you have one of the most powerful armies and the most brutal armies in the world. And on the one hand, you have a population that is, by and large, occupied, does not have much authority. So, indeed, I mean, you know, if Israel was really intent on, into entering serious negotiations for a two-state solution, there were many an opportunity from Oslo on and Camp David in 2000 and the resumption of the peace talks, the roadmap that George Bush dreamed up. And so on. So we asked time and time and time again. And most recently, there was that 9-month negotiating period between August of 2013 through March 2014, and where the Israelis wouldn't even deliver on this freeing prisoners who should have been freed back in 1994. So Israel was never serious about the two-state solution. They never are. And when you have the Likud saying we are not going to advocate it, yes, that is true, but it was also true on behalf of labor. Remember, Ehud Barak was a Liberite. Shimon Peres was a Liberite. Olmert and others were not Likudniks. So what you have is really on all sides of the, on both sides of the aisle in Israel, all the political groups basically will not agree to a Palestinian, independent Palestinian state because that will undermine the legitimacy of their own existence. That's how they see it. They see this as a struggle to the end. They see that the only way to end this struggle is by pacifying the Palestinians completely, and if they can throw them out of Palestine, then so much the better.
Yes, and it's just amazing how much time passes by and all these things, nothing fruitful other than Israel continues to gain more and more on the ground. And, you know, we talked about all these atrocities and all these measures that Israel has been doing for so many years in occupied East Jerusalem and throughout the West Bank and the occupied Palestinian territories. But we're talking about East Jerusalem. I couldn't help it, but just thinking about that incident where Israel demolished a cemetery, Mamilla Cemetery in Jerusalem. I mean, to build what's so-called a museum of tolerance, destroyed a historic significance in that cemetery with people buried there that are of significant, famous throughout the history, just like that. Imagine that's happening in the U.S. or anywhere in the world.
No, they can't. You cannot imagine because what Israel gets away with, no one else in the world will be able to get away with. Just, you know, look at what is happening now in the U.S. Congress. For instance, the Israelis have pushed, or AIPAC has pushed, the Israeli lobby has pushed the Senate and House to adopt measures that would criminalize boycotting Israel. So they will, you know, what Israel gets away with, no other country is able to get away with it.
Yep.
You know, boycott is part and parcel to the United States of America and its great history. The U.S. boycotted apartheid South Africa, you know, during the Civil Rights Movement. Americans boycotted the bus system, for instance, because it was segregated. There was also a boycott of non-union grapes in California, for instance. I mean, this country is based on, you know, a peaceful means of resistance, which is a boycott. Now the Israelis are trying to criminalize. So, yes, Israel gets away with a great deal, but on the other hand, you also have an amazingly resilient population, the Palestinians, who are not giving up, who are continuing to resist. And I think that will make all the difference. As we have seen in Jerusalem, this could set, you know, in motion a great deal of hope for the Palestinians that resistance works, that if you resist, you will able to extract your rights. And that is the message that is behind what has happened in Jerusalem.
And we were talking about the anti-BDS legislation during the first half of the hour before we started with you. And I mentioned how Israel, they prevented five U.S. Jewish, Christian, and Muslim activists from going to...
Interfaith,
In Dallas, to Israel.
At Dallas Airport outside Washington. That was yesterday. We raised the state of the crisis. And in fact, the state of the crisis was dumbfounded. They could not answer the question. But I did raise it because they prevented it from boarding the plane because they said that they have instructions and those who support the boycott will not be allowed to deplane once they get to Tel Aviv Airport.
This is amazing. So, not prevented.
And shamefully, the United States is basically looking the other way.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, a bit of activism will always put this issue forward. I think that what the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, did last week when they issued the letter and sent it to the senators, which made them take pause. You know, the Democratic senators basically were taken aback, and this is when we want to take another look at this before we criminalize supporting a boycott and boycott activities.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so we are going to leave it at this. Many thanks to our guest this evening, Saeed Ariqat, journalist, author, and political analyst. He is the Washington, D.C. bureau chief of the daily Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds, based in occupied Jerusalem. Thank you, Saeed, so much. We greatly appreciate your time this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. So what's your story is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
Community is all about connection, and KPFT is seeking local organizations, businesses, and individuals to participate in our community partner program. Community partners help KPFT by supporting station initiatives, reducing our pledge drives, and being key contributors to our success. As a community partner, your organization or business becomes invested in a richer way in KPFT and helps to keep local independent media flowing. Interested in being a community partner? Well, contact us by email at partners@kpft.org. Thanks for your interest in our Community Partners program. This is KPFT Houston.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is July 26th. On this day in 1865, Patrick Francis Healy was the first African-American to be awarded a Ph.D. degree from the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium. He taught philosophy at Georgetown University and was later selected as the school's 29th president. His influence at the institution was so profound that Healy was heralded as the school's second founder.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of